Welcome back to CineStudy, comprehensive takes on what makes movies great. Now for our 51st episode, Stanley Kubrick Ranked. Everybody, welcome back to CineStudy. I am your host, Dylan, and on today's episode, I will be ranking the films of this little-known hidden gem director known as Stanley Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick, of course, considered one of the greatest directors of all time. Without giving away my feelings on these movies too much, I can say I pretty much concur with that statement that he's, you know, got to be top five at least. A guy who didn't direct a ton of movies, but most of them are considered classics. A guy who wrote most of those movies too, which I guess can be somewhat unique for a lot of the most famous directors of all time. However, in another unique way, most of his filmography is based on existing literature. Most of his movies are adaptations. I feel like people don't really talk about that too much with Kubrick, and maybe it's because his movies have such a personal Kubrick stamp on them that you don't even think about it in that way. Like, you kind of remove the associations it has with the original text that it's based on for many of his movies, but I feel like we don't reference that very often. Of course, there's the obvious ones, you know, it's kind of inextricable, The Shining from Stephen King. There's never really been a conversation about how maybe his movies are lessened because he's got all of his stories from other places. Like, he's just bringing something to the screen. He's not necessarily offering something new. And maybe that's a testament to how much of a great director he is and, of course, a composer of shots that we don't really care that he's deriving all of his material from existing work. This was just kind of a separate little tangent to go on at the beginning of this episode. That honestly seems like something that's worthy of a lot of analysis, but something I'm not going to get into today. Today, I will just be ranking all of the feature films directed by Stanley Kubrick. I will, of course, not be including his three for-hire short films. I'll briefly reference them. You've got The Seafarers, which is basically a commercial for like a union of sailors, and it shows them going about their day in their clubhouse and stuff like that. You've got Day of the Fight, chronicling a day in the life of a boxer, which you would kind of see some of the elements of that return in one of Kubrick's movies. And you've got Flying Padre, a very short film about a priest who flies from village to village performing his duties. These are all real-life documentaries, and they're fine. You know, you watch them. If you didn't know they were Kubrick, you probably wouldn't even be able to guess. And there's maybe some people who are yelling at me right now and say, yes, when you watch it, it is so clearly Kubrick, but to me, it's like anybody could have made those. They're not the most memorable thing in the world. I did watch those years ago. I didn't have much interest in revisiting them before this episode, so I'm just going to set those aside for now. So without those, we have 13 total movies directed by Stanley Kubrick to rank today. A couple precursors. One, I will be ranking these by personal favorite. This is by no means an objective, this is the best Kubrick movie type of ranking. This is my personal favorites among his filmography in order. Two, just because it might be interesting, it took me a while to see all of his movies. Some of these I saw years and years and years ago for the first time, like Doctor Strangelove or 2001, but some of them I've only finally caught up with fairly recently. And there was no real rhyme or reason to the order that I approached his work. I kind of saw Doctor Strangelove in 2001, and around that time is when I was like, hey, now I understand who, like, good directors are and good movies are and classics, and then I was able to put all of his movies on my, you know, watch list for at some point in my life. And then I just kind of slowly chipped away at them. I didn't make, like, a huge effort to go finish them all in one fell swoop like I kind of did with Wes Anderson a couple years back. It was only recently that I was like, hey, I only have three more Kubrick movies. I should really wrap these up and be able to say that I've seen all of his movies and fully grasp all the works that he's put out there. And fully grasp is kind of a misnomer. Stanley Kubrick is a man who's clearly much smarter than I, and I can't say I really grasp the meaning of many of his messages and movies. most of his movies require many revisits, and that's not something I have set aside the time to do. So that's the other thing that's probably somewhat interesting about this list, is I am ranking all of these movies having only seen all of them once, with the exception of 2001 A Space Odyssey. I have seen that twice. It'd be interesting if I rewatched every single one of these, if I could, you know, stop time for a little while and go watch all of these and come back, if that would change my ranking at all, having seen them all in close proximity to each other. Because that sometimes does matter, you know? Sometimes you're years removed from one and you have different feelings. Maybe you remember liking it more then than you do now, or maybe you like it more now than your first impression. That can affect things, but, you know, these are all small details that we're going to have to ignore today. Precursor note number three, you most likely, most definitely will disagree with some of my placements on this list. And that's not because I have necessarily any huge hot takes on here. I honestly don't think I do. I think I'm fairly close to consensus on a lot of these. Sorry to ruin it, but, you know, there's not going to be a ton of surprises on this list. You disagreeing is more of a result of Stanley Kubrick having probably 9 or 10 of the overall 13 that all have ardent defenders that would probably say, no, this one is Kubrick's best movie. You could probably find somebody who would make a case for all of these movies as Kubrick's best movie, with the exception of maybe like one or two on this list, maybe even three. But 75% of this guy's catalog has its defenders who would probably say, this is Kubrick's best movie, or at least this is my absolute favorite, which is, of course, what's more pertinent to this conversation since I'm ranking by favorite. All of these movies have diehard fans. Kubrick is that much of a cult director, not in the sense that he has, like, that he's obscure or anything, but that he just has really dedicated followings to each of these movies. Obviously, there's whole conspiracy theories about at least 50% of these movies, so definitely has his dedicated followers, and that's why, you know, pretty much every movie I list off here, people are going to be like, what? That's not number one? But you know how lists work. You know how favorites work. I don't know what I'm even talking about, really. It's kind of dumb. Let's get into this thing, huh? While I said there's a lot up in the air, I think pretty much nobody would disagree that Fear and Desire has to be number 13 of Kubrick's filmography.
Waiting. Waiting to kill. Waiting to heal. Waiting to die. One by one, the men turned black. Then they were dead. And they knew it. I cannot quite admit that it is I who am creating slaughter in this abyss.
This was Stanley Kubrick's first movie. Very amateur indie film. This movie chronicles four soldiers who crash down behind enemy lines in an undisclosed war and start trying to navigate that situation. They come across some local people, and one of them starts losing his mind a little bit. I don't know. It's not really breaking a ton of new ground. I flat out don't like this movie. I rated it a 4 out of 10. It's pretty much the only movie I could say out of Kubrick's list here that is like, it's just not a great movie. The debut movie cannot always be a winner, you know, and even Kubrick acknowledges that this movie's kind of bumbling. He himself does not like this movie. This movie is only a little bit over 60 minutes long, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing. In the sense that it's a bad thing, this movie is really underdeveloped. It's really hard to get a great attachment to the characters, despite their troubling circumstances. The good thing about it being 60 minutes-ish is that it's over pretty quick, and you get to stop watching it. No, but really, I mean, the circumstances that these characters are in, nothing's all that crazy. I never really feel the tension of the scenario, even though it's supposedly this kind of, you know, high-stakes war moment. Just feels like we're kind of hanging out in the woods. The third act does try to ramp up the stakes a little bit and ramp up the action as well. But I don't know, it's a little bit tedious overall and kind of unexciting in how he executes it. And I can't really pinpoint it on one particular thing. The acting is surely a little bit unconvincing. All of these actors are amateur actors. There's a guy who's trying to kind of play crazy, but he's a little bit over the top. It's a little bit goofy. It just doesn't really feel authentic. And everybody else is pretty wooden. I don't know. It's just not a super exciting movie. This is probably the same thing where some people would say you can watch this, you can still see the Kubrickisms starting to show. I don't really see it. I find this movie to be a little bit uninspired. So, well, I won't spend any more time on that because this guy has way more movies to celebrate than to put down. So, moving on to number 12. At number 12, I have Killer's Kiss.
And out of the city's jungle night comes the clawing, burning impact of a killer's kiss. It hits with the gut shock of a knockout punch. A picture as brazen as the naked bulbs of Broadway and as hard as the New York streets where it was shot.
Can't you get it, Vinny? To me, you're just an old man. You smell bad.
I could kill you right here and now.
Oh, I don't think you will.
I wouldn't be too sure of that.
Don't kill me. I don't want to die. I'll do anything you say. Anything.
He was lost as soon as he looked at her.
This movie is also just barely over 60 minutes. It's a movie about a boxer, and he starts kind of getting into a tricky relationship with a local dancer and sort of this mob boss that employs her. I'm trying to sort of jog my memory on the story of this because it has been a long, long time since I've seen it. I have a pretty concrete opinion of it, even though I don't remember necessarily all of the details. I know that's probably bad list making here, but I don't know. I wanted to focus on watching the ones I hadn't seen, then revisiting ones that I remember being pretty lukewarm about. What I will say is this movie definitely does have the excitement and the tension that Fear and Desire chases, but doesn't quite get. There's sort of this end fight chase through a building, and there's like all these crates and mannequins, and you really do feel that kind of action set piece at the end, not in like a crazy way, but in like, oh yeah, this is a great climactic moment kind of way. The plot is sort of in line with your prototypical noir. The cinematography, sort of, a little bit less so. It doesn't have those really, you know, crazy memorable noir shadow shots like a movie like Double Indemnity or something that's kind of a standard of the genre would show. But it definitely has an inkling of those kind of staples to it. Again, it's kind of like at this point, I just want to keep ascending the list and talk about some more exciting movies. But to give it its due, it's not a bad watch at all. You're going to do worse with Fear and Desire. This is a movie that's perfectly fine, perfectly serviceable, entertaining. The characters are all right. The acting's all right. Everything here is just done a little bit more competently than what was done in Fear and Desire. So you already feel that step up from Kubrick. And he's starting to, you know, head up to some of his more renowned works. Again, not really a movie that I would watch and be able to identify blindly that it's a Kubrick movie. In the same way where if you watch A Clockwork Orange without knowing better and you had seen a couple other Kubrick movies, you'd be like, yeah, it's probably that guy, right? This one feels a little bit more down the middle studio style, even though it is indie. Just more in the sense of how it tells its story and stuff. So, not my favorite of his, but by no means a bad movie in the way that I think Fear and Desire is legitimately bad. I gave this a 6 out of 10. Moving up on the list, at number 11, we have one that tends to be a little bit divisive, I guess. I see some people place it much higher, but again, that's pretty much every movie left on this list is going to be widely varying in where people would put it on their favorites. I have Lolita. Lolita, I gave a 6 out of 10. This movie stars James Mason as a kind of creepy, pathetic pedophile. Sounds like a tough watch, and it is constantly regarded as such a controversial movie based on one of the most controversial books of all time. The tagline of this movie is, how did they ever make a movie out of Lolita? And for all that hype, you watch it, and it does not really feel all that transgressive. Not that I really wanted to kind of immerse myself in 2.5 hours of really creepy, gross pedophilia, but it never really felt like it was even approaching that boundary. Now, I think it's interesting that it doesn't really approach that boundary because this movie is definitely putting you in the perspective of James Mason's character, who I now cannot remember for the life of me how they pronounce in the movie. His name is Humbert Humbert or Humbert Humbert, and I feel like it's not Humbert Humbert, so I'm going to go with Humbert. One of the goofiest names I've heard in a movie in a long time, by the way. But we're clearly kind of in his perspective, and from his perspective, there's not really anything wrong with this relationship. So maybe it is a good choice that this relationship kind of feels normal, even though you definitely look at it objectively and say, that's wrong. It's not like there's a lot of scenes where like, ew, that's kind of gross. It's sort of, the movie treats it sort of plainly. And I just don't really know how I feel about that choice, you know? I don't really want to watch a bunch of really disturbing stuff, but I also don't want to kind of normalize it either. I don't really think that's what this movie's trying to do, but it certainly feels a little bit normal. At least while I was watching it, I never really felt like Kubrick was handling this as some extremely taboo thing. It was kind of taken straight down the middle. The story itself is a little bit unmemorable. I don't think we really get anywhere exciting with it. What could sort of be seen as the big build-up climactic moment that this whole story would be leading to is actually the first scene of the movie because it's told a little bit out of order. So it feels like we already kind of blew it on that, and then you kind of go back to square one, and you know it's just building towards that, so it's not really as exciting. Of course, many movies use that device, but I don't really feel like it helps this movie too much. All the performances, I will say, are a welcome step up from the last two. James Mason is really great in this movie. You just feel like there's this tension, this kind of paranoia. He's a guy who's trying to present himself very normally, but you can really feel that sort of under the skin and behind his eyes, there's like this really simultaneously pathetic but super tense person. He conveys that really well. All the performances in this movie are pretty strong, and that's what kind of salvages this movie for me. Peter Sellers turns it up to 11 in this movie. He's playing such a goofy character, a precursor of things to come with Dr. Strangelove. It's not quite to that degree in Lolita, but he's certainly dialing it up. And he is madly entertaining in this movie. But overall, I kind of walk away from it just feeling like, yeah, that was fine. It was competent. It was okay. It wasn't as sort of provocative or risky as it kind of could have been. It's a movie that plays a very controversial piece of literature kind of safe. And I don't know. Again, it's like I don't really know how to feel about that, but what we did get, I don't necessarily love. All right, moving on upward. At number 10, we have The Killing. And we're solidly into, like, I really enjoy this movie territory with The Killing already.
Give or take a few thousand. I figure the loot on this deal at 2 million. There should be that much in the track offices.
Killing is Kubrick's attempt at the classic noir. I mentioned he was kind of hinting at it with Killer's Kiss. He really gets there with The Killing, a heist movie starring Sterling Hayden and a cast of other characters. Sterling Hayden has one of the great names in noir history, Johnny Clay, and they're trying to pull off a heist at a horse race, which is just such a unique choice for a location for a heist. You know, we've seen noir heist movies pretty much everywhere. A horse race is one that you don't see all too often. And of course, there's the typical kind of backstabbing and things going wrong, bad coincidences that sort of start to derail this thing, and we see if he can get away with it or not. And it is a fun ride. If there was any movie I wish I revisited before ranking Kubrick movies, it would be this one, because this one probably has the highest potential for moving upwards. This movie is very slick. The characters are all fun. The performance are all fun. It's just got those classic staples of shadows and smoke and great kind of heist concepts that you would come to expect from a noir and are very adeptly handled when given to Stanley Kubrick. The heist itself is just so much fun to watch. There's a little bit of build-up to it, and then once you get there, it is just quite the ride. And the last couple scenes of this movie, it's a great stinger of an ending. Again, a movie I'd like to rewatch very soon. I gave it a 7 out of 10. I feel like it could easily bump up to an 8 out of 10 next time I see it. I really enjoy this movie. It just happens to be the case that all the other movies left by Stanley Kubrick I like even more. What can I say? The guy makes a lot of good movies. Of course, some of the good ones are going to fall low relative to the others. Moving on up to number 9 is the movie that people make the case is Stanley Kubrick's least actually directed movie that he really didn't have much of a say in, that it was Kirk Douglas running the show and Trumbo's script propelling this thing, and that is Spartacus.
I bring a message from your master, Marcus Licinius Crassus, commander of Italy. By command of his most merciful excellency, your lives are to be spared. Slaves you were, and slaves you remain. But the terrible penalty of crucifixion has been set aside on the single condition that you identify the body or the living person of the slave called Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus!
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 I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
Spartacus Spartacus might have been the movie in Kubrick's filmography that I was dreading to watch the most. Big swords and sandals epic, super long. It just doesn't really seem like my thing. I hadn't really seen a lot in this sort of Roman epic genre, but it just already seemed like not my thing. And I was delightfully surprised by Spartacus. What's new? It's Stanley Kubrick. I don't know why I could possibly go into a Stanley Kubrick movie with bad expectations. It doesn't make any sense. Kirk Douglas is great in this movie. I guess I don't really need to recap the plot of Spartacus. Of course, a Roman slave who led a giant slave revolt in Rome. A slave who is a gladiator slave, by the way. I guess that's sort of the interesting side note to that. This movie is separated into two halves by an intermission, and I feel like that's a good way to talk about it. You get the first half, which is sort of the introduction to Spartacus and the rise of this revolt. And then the second half is when things start to come to a head with some Roman senators who are maybe not liking this Spartacus revolt. You know, maybe the people in power don't necessarily like the slaves rising up. I guess that's, you know, not exactly a shocker. But a little bit more nuance to what's going on in the political sphere of Rome. There's some backstabbing. There's some sides being taken by the different diplomats there. And that makes for kind of an exciting B story while you watch Spartacus rise. This movie is so chock full of great performances by an absolutely loaded cast. Kirk Douglas, I mentioned, is great. Laurence Olivier plays a fantastic villain as Crassus. Charles Lawton is great as Gracchus. Tony Curtis, as sort of Spartacus's right-hand man, feels maybe slightly out of place in this movie, but I feel like by the end he won me over. When he first was introduced, I was like, I don't really know if I enjoy seeing the guy who I know more from like some Like It Hot and Sweet Smell of Success in this. It just felt very out of type for Tony Curtis, but he won me over by the end. But perhaps the real scene stealer is Peter Ustinov as Bataitis, who is the gladiator trainer who kind of works his way through more of the plot than you would think later on in the movie. Something about him, he was magnetic in this movie. I feel like he was the most naturalist performance, which was kind of a unique spin considering we're playing all these, like, you know, high and mighty Roman dignitaries. He kind of bumbles around from time to time. He's a little bit nervous sometimes, but he's also trying to gain stuff for himself, retain some control. He is a great character, and he is brought to the screen very well by Peter Ustinov. Possibly my favorite takeaway from this movie is his performance, which I believe he was nominated or even awarded for the Oscars. The action in this movie is great, like the gladiator fights or some of the big battles. I was really wondering how Kubrick was going to be able to pull that off, because the other Kubrick movies I had seen, that wasn't really something he ever brought to the table. You know, like big action spectacle was not really a Kubrick thing. There is, of course, visual spectacle, but not necessarily like, hey, we're coordinating tons of people to make this big fight. He gets at it a little bit with Barry Lyndon, but I hadn't seen that at this point. So I was curious how he would handle it, and he does it well. This one, you do kind of feel that there is a lot of studio oversight, that we're playing it pretty straightforward a lot of the time, but and it's still Kubrick, so he does that straightforward very well. I like Spartacus a lot. I know some people are kind of down on it because they're like, it's not a real Kubrick movie, but I thought it was quite enjoyable and a big surprise for me. But again, only number 9 because there's a lot of other Kubrick movies to like more. At number 8, I have probably the first one that people are going to go ahead and throw their arms up about and say that's way too low. I have A Clockwork Orange. A lot of people are very upset, I know. Especially knowing what's still to come, you might be looking at some other movies I put ahead of it and be like, why is that ahead of Clockwork Orange? Look, man, these are just my favorites. He's a good director, all right? They're all winners. I like A Clockwork Orange a lot. You know, where I was saying Lolita plays it safe, Clockwork Orange does quite the opposite. Lots of disturbing content in Clockwork Orange. And maybe that's why this one's a little bit lower on the favorites list, is because I don't foresee a lot of rewatch value out of it. Whereas some of the ones I have higher on the list, I'd like to revisit pretty soon. Clockwork Orange, I'm sure I'll see again at some point, but it's not one I'm necessarily running out to go see again. Now, I will say Kubrick is insanely successful at creating what feels like an entirely different world in this movie. It's technically grounded in our world. It's a futuristic Great Britain, but it feels like another planet. The production design is insane in this movie. I'm thinking mainly of the interiors in this movie. The interiors are nuts. Some of the color choices, the way the architecture is developed, it is crazy and it's beautiful to look at. And the interiors do great at kind of corresponding with the tone. You know, you've got all these kind of colorful interiors when Alex is kind of, you know, running his mayhem. a bit of the old ultra violence, as he says. And then you get to kind of the prison act of this movie and everything becomes kind of brown and gray and subdued and gross. And it's funny because that's theoretically the kind of moral good as we're trying to correct this guy who's an absolutely terrible criminal. And from his perspective, this is the really boring, bland place. A Clockwork Orange as a book, as a, you know, piece of work, has some very complicated themes that, as I mentioned earlier, go right over my head, I think. I haven't spent nearly enough time breaking down some of the themes and messages of Kubrick's movies because they are so complex to me. At least they just feel daunting. You know, maybe I'll understand it someday. But moral of the story is I love how kind of inextricable the visuals are from kind of the themes of the movie. You know, kind of taking away free will in the name of good and sort of the balancing act of those two things, or maybe it's not a balancing act at all. Maybe it is a truly bad thing, as I would say this movie probably suggests. You certainly feel that kind of balance the movie is trying to represent between, you know, free will and like moral good and kind of the interplay between those two things and what's right and what's wrong. And can you really have one without the other, or can you not even have good with free will? I don't know. This seems to be the kind of the juxtaposition this movie is trying to lay out. And it's a little bit too complicated for me to digest in one sitting. So probably the one I need to rewatch the most on this list. I want to rewatch probably The Killing the most, but Clockwork Orange probably the one I need to rewatch the most. But I think the visuals of this movie are really where it sings. The costuming, the production design, Kubrick's trademark cinematography that makes you feel very uneasy and on edge all the time. And a kind of synth score that is pretty memorable and, you know, off-putting. I don't have too much more to say about A Clockwork Orange, which might be disappointing to some of you. But for now, we will keep on moving up. An 8 out of 10 for both Spartacus and A Clockwork Orange. I'm not sure I mentioned that. Coming in at number 7, Eyes Wide Shut. Kubrick's final film that chronicles the odyssey of Tom Cruise through a nighttime New York that involves a whole lot of disturbing sexual encounters. Is it weird that I think this movie is rewatchable? I've only seen it once in total, but I find myself watching scenes from it every now and then and being like, yeah, I love this scene. I love this part. This is not really a movie that you would normally classify as that, right? It's a very weird and kind of dark tale to just want to revisit random scenes from it, but here we are. The acting in this movie is interesting to talk about because, at least for Tom Cruise, it's a little bit wooden, but it feels almost purposefully wooden and very fittingly wooden, that you're kind of watching this guy that you could imprint any personality onto just kind of float through this city. It just feels right, and I don't really know how that works, that the sort of, you know, monotone one-note acting that you get from a lot of the characters in this movie feels perfect for the movie. It's not even necessarily bad acting, it just feels like a choice, and it's something about it really works. And I feel like it's sort of that feeling of emptiness that this movie's trying to convey, that there's a lot of this random stuff going on, but is any of it fulfilling? Not really. Does Tom Cruise or Nicole Kidman really change by the end of this movie? It's arguable. I would say not really. I would say they're probably going to revert to their same old ways pretty soon. This movie's kind of depicting the like this kind of grosser and more uncomfortable side of marriage, and then extrapolating that into this absolutely absurd journey around New York. I love nighttime city movies, if that makes any sense. I don't know. Like, movies like After Hours, Taxi Driver, Sweet Smell of Success to some degree. I don't know, there's something about a kind of messed up guy walking around a city at night and getting into some weird encounters that is just my kind of movie. And this is one of the great examples of that. And when we leave New York, this might be a very basic opinion, but that's where this movie really takes off. You were waiting for it, you know about it, you finally get to that moment. You know, and maybe if you don't, I won't say much more than that. This movie hits another level for me. I feel like the sequence inside the mansion is some of the best filmmaking I've ever seen. And there's a single cut, a single moment that is one of the more like heart dropping to my stomach moments I've ever felt the first time I watched this movie. And I'll address exactly what that is, like specifically at the end of this episode behind the spoiler wall. But for now, I can't give any more credit to that sequence. That sequence is incredible. And again, that might be a basic take. I think probably the people who really love this movie see a lot more nuance than just like, oh yeah, I love that part. I think that's entirely the right opinion, but I can't help but say when we get to that mansion, man, this movie is great. I think the lighting in this movie is pretty unbelievable. a lot of the like Christmas lights and neon and stuff like that. It just feels so natural. It's something that could feel very showy otherwise, but instead it just feels like a seamless part of the shot of the production. Specifically in that opening party, there's lights everywhere that you could feel like, oh, this is kind of just, you know, flaunting great cinematography. But instead it feels very naturally beautiful. Kubrick's good at that, man. Some of the most beautiful shots you've ever seen are in Kubrick movies, but they never really call attention to themselves. Eyes Wide Shut, a great way for Kubrick's career to end. I know there is kind of some polarizing takes on that. I know some people really don't like Eyes Wide Shut. It might be his most divisive movie. For me, I'm definitely on the pro side. Thoroughly enjoy it, even though it is number 7 on this list, because again, I thoroughly enjoy many of his movies. Moving on up to number 6, I have Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, my first Kubrick movie.
He can barrel that baby in solo. You ought to see it sometime. It's a sight. A big plane, like a 52 room. It's jet exhaust frying chickens in the barnyard.
Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and
Love the Bomb.
A moving picture.
Love that bomb.
Kubrick's only true comedy, I would say. This is the only one that sets out to be a comedy and fulfills that from start to finish. First of all, you can't separate this movie from Peter Sellers, who plays three characters absolutely wonderfully and totally differently. It's hard to see the same guy underneath the costume for all three. He's that much of a fun chameleon in these characters. He's adding so many quirks and mannerisms to all of them, of course, especially the titular Dr. Strangelove. The comedy in this movie, to me at least, is never like laugh out loud funny. It's sort of like smirk, or like kind of like a quick chuckle, or like a huh, you know. It's probably sounded really dumb, but it's not like a movie that where you're like, you know, busting a gut laughing. It's sort of like you're impressed by how clever it is, and that's what makes it, you know, comedic. Dr. Strangelove, of course, a big Cold War satire when some nukes are inadvertently sent towards Russia and we're trying to figure out how to navigate that situation. And we have some very eccentric characters trying to figure that out, whether it be Dr. Strangelove, Colonel Jack D. Ripper behind the trigger, played wonderfully by Sterling Hayden, who's always great in Kubrick movies. And of course, you have to love George C. Scott as General Buck Turgidson, who is just bouncing off the walls in some of these scenes. I know he's famously very unhappy with the takes that Kubrick used in this movie, because those were all the takes where he was told to like absolutely go crazy, you know, like don't even worry about it. It's not going to be used. And then they use the really insane part and he feels like it's just too much. I think it's perfect for this movie. I think it's perfect to take this setting that so normally we see people who are like super restrained and devastated by the seriousness of this matter. Take Oppenheimer, for example. And instead, we're just showing that these personalities are immature that are dealing with this, that they're somewhat incompetent. They are fueled by a lot of ego, a lot of self-interest, a lot of bias, a lot of very strong, possibly unfounded personal beliefs. There is a lot of nonsense to these characters in a good way, where it's like, yeah, we're taking one of the most important things, and it's like, do you realize that the people who are making these decisions are a little bit insane? Just a little bit. And again, it's like, it's a comedy that I feel like everybody can appreciate, because it's never setting out to be like, watch this and just die of laughter at this slapstick moment, or if this comeback or this pun or whatever, you know. It's like everything's a little bit more high-minded than that in a good way, where it's just like, yeah, you're just kind of you're entertained by the sheer absurdity of it all, and not in like a, you know, Airplane or Naked Gun way, more of like a, I can't believe we're dealing with this subject in this way sort of feeling. Dr. Strangelove, pretty fun. I do really like the production design of the war room and some of these other locations. And of course, Kong riding the bomb is one of the great, you know, maybe top 10 Kubrick shots, I think. Even though it's one of the more like inauthentic shots, like one of the more like stagey, showy shots than some of the other ones, it sticks in my head. I love it. Okay, quick look behind the scenes. I need to take a quick break from recording this episode, and I will probably be recording it in a different place when you hear the next half of this. So if the audio sounds a little bit differently, just forgive me and move on. So coming up next, the top 5 Kubrick movies, and if the audio sounds a little different, I apologize. Okay, we are back. Again, sorry if the audio sounds a little bit different. Might sound better, might sound worse, but I'm just in a different place. Let's keep moving. Coming in at number 5 is Paths of Glory, starring Kirk Douglas as Colonel Dax, who is a military commander who's been ordered to basically take this hill that is going to lead to a lot of casualties. It's sort of a fruitless mission, a pointless mission, but he's been ordered to do it. And there's kind of a series of mistakes and choices, some cowardice and things of that nature that lead to the second half of this movie, which is entirely different. I went into this movie expecting it to be kind of Kubrick's full war movie, and it is for maybe 40%, but then it transitions to much more of a straight drama, sort of a courtroom drama in a lot of ways, where we see a lot of payoffs to things that happened in the first half of the movie, see how they kind of affect things down the line. This movie tackles bravery and cowardice, it tackles scapegoating, it tackles sort of the, you know, pointlessness of war, as you would come to expect from a lot of these war movies, and that's echoed a little bit better in one of Kubrick's later movies, in my humble opinion, but we will get there. And it's a movie that's just thoroughly gripping from start to finish. Kirk Douglas gives possibly one of my all-time favorite performances in this movie. He's a man carrying so much integrity and intensity. He seems very serious and reserved, and he is willing to kind of rein in his attitudes and kind of, you know, treat things cordially until every now and then a pure burst of emotion comes out of him.
Colonel Dex, how would you like a General Miro's job?
His what, sir?
His job.
Let me get this straight, sir. You're offering me General Miro's command?
Come, come, Colonel Dax, don't overdo the surprise. You've been after the job from the start. We all know that, my boy.
I may be many things, sir. But I'm not your boy.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to imply any biological relationship.
I'm not your boy in any sense.
You're trying to rogue me, Colonel?
Why should I want to do that?
Exactly. It would be a pity to lose your promotion before you get it. A promotion you have so very carefully planned for.
Sir, would you like me to suggest what you can do with that promotion?
Colonel Dax! You will apologize at once or I shall be placed under arrest.
I apologize for not being entirely honest with you. I apologize for not revealing my true feelings. I apologize, sir, for not telling you sooner that you're a degenerate, sadistic old man. And you can go to hell before I apologize to you now or ever again.
Kirk Douglas handles this character terrifically, and I really like his work here. This is a very bleak movie. It's not necessarily a movie you walk away from feeling good about anything in the slightest sense. In fact, you feel very probably disillusioned with a lot of things out of this movie if you weren't already. This might be Kubrick's best movie in terms of character interplay. I mean, there's great characters and very iconic characters in a lot of his other movies, whether it be, you know, Hal or you know, Jack Torrance in The Shining or Alex DeLarge. But I think this movie, while not as iconic in terms of the characters themselves, the sort of the interplay and the dynamics between the characters and their different qualities and how they interact, I think is some of the best sort of narrative work that he's done. This is a movie that'll make you mad in a lot of ways. Not only is it bleak, but there's just a lot of indefensible people in this movie. Characters you really hate, who seem to get their way a lot. I think as a straight drama, it's one of Kubrick's best. And a lot of the Kubrick hallmarks are executed perfectly here. A lot of his trademark shots, like the kind of tracking shot that leads a character along, in this case being Kirk Douglas's Colonel Dax through the trenches, just sticks in your mind immediately. I love how he films everything, the night scenes in this movie. I think this is a great Kubrick movie. It's one that, I don't know, I have seen people rank this as high as like his second best, his first best movie, and as low as like his ninth, because again, I think I've said it a billion times, you know, everybody has their favorite. This is one that it's hard to imagine why people is like, this is a personal favorite, because it is so, you know, bleak and hard to watch. Not hard to watch, but it's like, you know, you don't necessarily feel good while watching it. But I think the execution of this movie is what makes it a personal favorite among his movies for me. I just really respect everything he's doing in this movie, and it feels like one of his first major strides into the Kubrick we know after his early career. That would kind of regress a little bit with Spartacus and Lolita, but I think this is a great gem from the first third of Kubrick's movies. I think I might have mini-reviewed this a long time ago. I might be speaking out of turn, but I feel like I did. Speaking of movies I feel like I mini-reviewed, coming in at number 4, I have Full Metal Jacket. This is what I was alluding to. I think this is Kubrick's best representation of sort of the emptiness and pointlessness of war. Okay, sorry to interject again with what might be another audio change. The world has been working against me, and it's been a logistical nightmare trying to get this episode done. I've now had to break it into 3 different chunks, so we're sitting down now a third time, and I'm going to definitely finish it this time, so hopefully a little bit more continuity through the end. But sorry for any audio changes or moments where I'm going to be scratching my head trying to remember things I said earlier. But anyway, moving on. I believe where I left off was talking about Full Metal Jacket, my number four pick on this list.
Well, everybody's heard about the bird. Bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. The bird's a winner. Well, the bird, bird, bird. Well, the bird is a winner. Well, the bird, bird. The bird's a winner.
A movie that's constantly referred to as a tale of two halves. Now, I defended the second half of this movie, which is usually referred to as the weaker half. I said certainly it is a little bit lesser than what is almost a flawless first half of the movie, or first 40 minutes, rather. But it's like you kind of can't have the movie without that second half, is what I kind of stood by. I talked about this in that mini-review, or I believe it was a rapid-fire review, where I covered this movie. And I stand by all my previous thoughts. I think this movie has to have the second half to work, and to kind of provide a very cool juxtaposition to the first half. I think there's two strengths to the way this kind of half-split structure works. First of all, the first half ends on a very dark and dour note that I won't spoil if you haven't seen Full Metal Jacket. And there's so much just crazy, kind of upsetting and unsettling stuff bleeding through that first half. And then we transition to the war. And then we actually have to go out into the real conditions. It's like, you thought it was bad, now we haven't even gotten to the wartime part yet, which I think is a pretty cool transition by Kubrick. Because you're like, well, now it's going to get even worse. The first half had so much comedy and sort of exciting, engaging moments, and now it's like, okay, we're going to probably strip these away and move into a much more depressing second half of this movie, or a little bit more of a consequential second half, that is. There were certainly stakes in the first half and certainly some big moments, but now it's like, okay, it's life or death. Even so, the second half is juggled with some levity. There's some funny cinematic choices. There's some funny song choices, certainly. But Kubrick leaves us with an ending that is equal parts bleak as the ending of the first half. So in all of these scenarios, while he's providing a little bit of entertainment along the way, the last note he leaves you with is like, oh, this is actually awful. Showing kind of all the problems inherent in the system before we even get to wartime, and then showing the terrible conclusions of both, I think is kind of a cool mirrored way of telling the story. And I think this is some of the stronger performances in a Kubrick movie. Matthew Modine is very convincing as our protagonist, dealing with the war with a little bit of levity, but also seeing some real pain kind of bleed through. The whole cast is quite entertaining. Vincent D'Onofrio gives what I think is probably his defining performance as Private Pyle. He has such a seamless transition from the start of this movie to where he ends up about 45 minutes in, and it's so convincingly brought to life by D'Onofrio. You feel so much pain for him, but you also have this really dark and twisted side of you that's like laughing at him a little bit too, and it just makes all of the consequences of his character arc even more devastating and upsetting. And maybe I just painted myself to be a terrible person that I was laughing at him too, but I mean, you can't say when he's eating that donut you're not kind of giggling a little bit, right? As kind of sad and pitiful as that moment simultaneously is. Of course, Arlie Ermey defines a lot of this movie with his absolutely insane diatribes and rants towards his soldiers. It's hard to even pick a favorite line because he just rattles off winner after winner. There's so many funny quotes from him packed into any given 3 minutes of him talking. And I think that kind of echoes what I was saying of why this movie works so well. The first half, there's like actual roaring laughter that you can generate with this movie with just Arlie Ermey doing his thing. It's so funny from time to time. It's also a little bit upsetting when he goes a little bit too far or does something that you don't agree with, but you can't help but laugh at some of his insults and their absolute creativity and originality. And then when we get out into the real war, it's like, okay, things have really changed. The tone has taken a shift. We're holding on to that comedy and trying to look at the war in kind of this different sense that Joker sees it through, but it does still feel like a stark contrast. And I feel like it works. I feel like it kind of throws you off balance from all the conditions you were immersed in to now where you are as the movie progresses. I don't know if I'm really correctly putting into words the success that I see between the first half and the second half and how they kind of match each other. But I am one of those defenders that thinks the movie doesn't just totally take a nosedive after the first half. I'm kind of confused by that sentiment, honestly. I would definitely acknowledge that the first half is stronger, but I think a lot of people's arguments come from the fact that the first half is just more fun and has a little bit more shocking moments to it along the way. The second half is still Kubrick at some of his best, and I think Full Metal Jacket is a movie that tends to slip down the rankings a little bit. Not too far. I mean, people acknowledge it's a great movie, but I don't know. I guess I probably have it higher than a lot of people. Which is also funny because I'm not like the world's biggest war movie fan. It's not that I feel any particular type of way about them. I just tend to see a lot of repetition in them, and you know, they're not exactly rewatchable either, and those are the things that tend to stick in my head. So coming from me, putting this high should say a lot about Kubrick's war movie, at least in my evaluation of it. All right, coming in at number three is the most recent Kubrick movie I saw, the very last one that I hadn't seen. And it's one that could slide up to the two spot in the future, but for now, I put it at three. I didn't want to let too much recency bias slip through. And that movie is Barry Lyndon. Now, I feel like Barry Lyndon is regarded as one of Kubrick's best works to Kubrick fans, to people that are super into movies or super into Kubrick. But it doesn't really get mentioned in the same sentence as 2001 or The Shining or Clockwork Orange and sort of the wider public consciousness of Kubrick. And it's pretty easy to understand why. It's 3 hours. It's a period piece. Again, to like big movie fans or to big Kubrick fans, Barry Lyndon is nothing new. I'm not really trying to make a case that it's like this underrated gem. But I do wish it was kind of mentioned in that same sweeping statement about Kubrick as some of his other big hitters. But, you know, it's just not going to ever be in that classification. It's not one that people are just going to throw on just because, like, they might give a chance to The Shining or Clockwork Orange. It's just too intimidating of a watch. And I think that's a shame, but it's sort of inherent with a movie like this. But this is one of the best movies I've seen in recent memory, and certainly one of the best Kubrick movies. And, of course, now one of my favorites. First of all, Ryan O'Neill. He's in a couple classics, he's on TV, people know him, but I had never seen him before, and seeing him in this role, I thought he was great. There's a lot of conversation out there about him being terrible in this movie, and I was kind of baffled by it, frankly. I'm like, unless I'm really missing something, I feel like he's pretty good as Barry Lyndon, or Redmond Barry. Random place to start, but I don't know, I just wanted to get that off my chest. I don't really know where there's a lot of internet hate for Ryan O'Neill in this movie. People love the movie for other reasons, but they like very explicitly say that he's not one of them, and I'm like, okay, that's kind of strange. I feel like he's pretty good, but maybe that's just me. I don't really have a ton new to offer about Barry Lyndon or the movies that I will be putting at my number two or number one spot because they are so thoroughly analyzed out there. I mean, really all of Kubrick's movies are like that, but I feel like what can I really say about this movie that hasn't been said already? I know I tend to say that a lot on this podcast in general, but that's what happens when you cover a lot of classics, I guess. Every frame of this movie is like a painting. That's a sentence you'll hear a lot, and a sentence I wholly agree with. You could screenshot any moment in this movie and analyze it thoroughly and be like, wow, this shot is absurdly cool. But they're far-ranging in their scope. You will have a beautiful shot that's just a close-up of a face lit only by candlelight. Then you'll have a shot that's beautiful, but because it's tons and tons of candles illuminating this grand ballroom with immense production design and all these people crowded around a card game, and it's like, yeah, that looks like a Renaissance painting. And then you'll have kind of these sweeping landscapes and vistas that look like they're painted beautifully in pastel. And even amidst all that, I was not expecting for there to be some action war cinematography in this movie. Yeah, that caught me out of left field. I did not know anything about this movie going in, and having Kubrick kind of film some war-like set pieces in a movie that, you know, is not associated with Kubrick war movies like Full Metal Jacket or Paths of Glory is really caught me off guard, and of course he did it well as usual. When the camera's moving, it's beautiful. When the camera's totally stationary, it's beautiful. If you Google Barry Lyndon and just scroll down through Google Images, you'll be like, yeah, these are classical paintings. This is insane. And when you see those images on your own, there is probably a part of you that instinctually is like, that's a boring period piece movie. But man, is the storyline so riveting. Redmond Barry's introduced to us off the bat, and he has just like one little goal in mind. He's in love with this one girl, and he wants to marry her. And the chain reaction that we set off by just that little starting point, it just really keeps you on your toes in a fun way. Like, I did not know where we were going next with each scene, but they made so much sense the way things progressed. The way it built from this localized story to now he's a soldier to now he's here, there, working his way up the kind of social hierarchy. And where he ends up further down the line, you're like, well, he did that. There's like this cool sense of progression. And I won't say too much about what happens once he gets to those kind of major milestones because, again, there is a lot of unpredictability here if you've never seen it, in my opinion. I never really knew where we were going next. I didn't find myself trying to guess where we were going next too much because I was just along for the ride in a really fun way. And again, you're supplementing it with some of the most beautiful lighting and cinematography you'll ever see. I believe Kubrick got specialized NASA cameras just to be able to film natural candlelight and light all of his scenes with purely candlelight, and it pays off. It looks so cool. it's hard to talk about this movie without just getting super excited, which is just so funny and somewhat contradictory to a movie that is kind of this daunting period piece that has its slow sequences and very deliberate moments. But man, is it a great watch. And again, it's not like this movie is really like an underrated classic that I need to scream from the rooftops about. Like, people have known this. This has been around. It's just a matter of when you get to it. I think it's great. I can wholly understand why it wouldn't be somebody's cup of tea. I think if you go in with crossed arms and you're like, I don't want to watch this with a period piece, it might win you over. I could very easily see somebody going in with crossed arms and just shutting it out completely and never taking it in. But if you go along for the ride, if you buy into it, I feel like you will have a good time with Barry Lyndon. Great music, too. Kubrick just kind of pulls from resources of classical music for pretty much all of his movies. But I feel like this is some of his better selections. The kind of like beautiful sweeping, I think it's like sort of this flute overture at the beginning. And then some of the main themes that run through the second half of the movie. They're all really good. They kind of stick in your head and they don't get old. All right, I'm probably going to have to cut myself off from talking about Barry Lyndon because this is a movie that I could really talk about for a long, long time. And it's going to be the same with the number two and the number one. Maybe less so with the number two, which is why I think long-term Barry Lyndon might beat it out. But for now, again, I don't want to let too much recency bias slip through because number two is an established favorite. And that number two is The Shining. The Shining, of course, one of the great horror classics, an adaptation of Stephen King's novel, which he does not enjoy at all. He does not like this Kubrick movie, which is sort of crazy to me because if I wrote a book, even if I like loved that book, it was near and dear to my heart. And if somebody adapted it and they made a ton of changes, you know, off the bat, I'd be like, oh, okay, that kind of sucks. They've made so many changes. But then if I saw that the changes they made were just Kubrick's The Shining, I'd be like, all right, that's fine. that's okay with me. Because I feel like this movie and what you now can probably deduce as my number one, they're sort of undeniable. Jack Nicholson gives a career-defining performance here. He's so unhinged by the end of this movie, it's absolutely great. But he does do that descent into madness rather slowly, just like so many other Kubrick characters do. I did a whole mini-review episode on this movie, so if you want some more, you know, detailed and recent to me seeing the movie again thoughts about The Shining, I would check that out. But I will still shout out some more stuff here. I think Shelley Duvall is very underrated in this movie. There is definitely a camp that says she's really terrible and annoying in this movie. I don't get it. I think it is the most convincing horror movie victim role that I've ever seen. I feel like her fear is the most palpable of any character running from a monster or a bad guy in a horror movie I've ever seen. And that's kind of a weird way of describing it, but you know what I mean. Basically, the protagonist in a horror movie, she's the most convincing in terms of her fear and just the desperation that she has throughout the whole movie. I won't get into the behind-the-scenes stuff too much. That's been thoroughly explored, and I think it's pretty bad. I think Kubrick is well-established to be a bit of a cruel control freak. I don't think the ends justify the means in getting this amazing performance out of Shelley Duvall, but I'm only going to address the ends in this case where I say Shelley Duvall is amazing in this movie. One of the great child performances too, you know, a place where many movies go wrong is just having a bad child performance in the middle of it. In this case, it's at the center of this movie alongside Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, and Danny Lloyd's great. Production design sings in this movie, the look of the Overlook, the colors, the creepiness and unsettling nature to sort of this empty, isolated place. The iconic looks of the carpet or the bathroom in room 237. The iconic moments like the blood elevator or here's Johnny navigating the maze at night. The long, long quest of Scatman Crothers to the Overlook that ends the only way it possibly could. The movie juggles kind of the two great ways of scaring you pretty equally. There's tons of suspense. On the one hand, you know, Danny riding his tricycle around and you're like, you know he's going to find something bad, but you're just waiting for it. So many great moments of tension in this movie. But it also has the shock. It has the startling moments to it. The horrifying visuals that flash up in just a quick burst onto the screen and then go away by the time you've even registered what you're looking at. The Shining is certainly a horror masterpiece and a movie that I kind of take for granted as being as good as it is. It's just like, yeah, it's The Shining. It's great. You know, what more is there to it? But you have to kind of put it into words sometimes. Strong music selections here, by the way, too. Midnight, The Stars and You. Great tune rolling through the movie. Really enjoy The Shining, not really breaking any new ground here in talking about it. Just like I'm not going to break any new ground in talking about my absolute favorite Kubrick movie. One of my top, probably 10, 15 favorite movies ever. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Well, hell, I'm damned if I can find anything wrong with it.
Yes. It's puzzling. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before. I would recommend that we put the unit back in operation and let it fail. It should then be a simple matter to track down the cause. We can certainly afford to be out of communication for the short time it will take to replace it.
X-ray Delta One, this is Mission Control. Roger, your 1930. We concur with your plan to replace number one unit to check fault prediction. We should advise you, however, that our preliminary findings indicate that your onboard 9000 computer is in error predicting the fault. I say again, in error predicting the fault. I know this sounds rather incredible, but this conclusion is based on the results from our twin 9000 computer. We are skeptical ourselves, and we are running cross-checking routines to determine reliability of this conclusion. Sorry about this little snag, fellas, and we'll get this info to you just as soon as we work it out. X-ray Delta One, this is Mission Control. 2049er, transmission concluded.
I hope the two of you are not concerned about this.
No, I'm not, Al.
Are you quite sure?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question, though.
Of course.
How would you account for this discrepancy between you and the Twin 9000?
Well, I don't think there is any question about it. It can only be attributable to human error. This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
First time I saw this movie was just absolutely mind-blowing. I saw it in an IMAX theater, completely empty except for me and a friend of mine. And that, I think, was the most transcendent way to see that movie for the first time. Iconic music, groundbreaking effects with miniatures, and just so many great practical tricks. I think of all the spinning shots of, like, sinking the camera to spinning tubes and tunnels and buildings so that things look anti-gravity, or like the stick-on shoes towards the beginning of the movie. It's really interesting because there's so much ingenuity going into how they built the crazy sets and practical effects of this movie. If you watch the movie just thinking about that, you will have an absolutely great time just trying to figure out how they did everything. And reading about it and researching it is another interesting rabbit hole on its own. But at the same time, it's so hard to watch the movie and think about those things because you are entirely caught up in the awe of the visuals and the just kind of beauty and breathtaking nature of a lot of the cinematography. There's so many stunning shots that you can easily just get caught up in that and just breaking down the image and what's there. But then when you think about how they actually did it behind the scenes, it's like this whole separate fun way to go into the movie. Great for your, like, you know, second, third watch, you know? I'm kind of at a loss on where to go next and talking about this movie. It's sort of, there's so much ground to cover when you talk about it. Stating the obvious, Hal is one of the great movie villains. I absolutely love everything to do with him. The kind of stinger that happens right before the intermission of this movie just made my jaw drop the first time I saw the movie. It, like, drops your heart. You're like, oh, no, that's really bad. And then it goes to intermission, and you just have to sit with it for a little while. And I was like, that's a great, great moment. Hal as a visual, this kind of understated red light that's still so eerie and creepy and feels like he's all-knowing and all-around. Very well done there. Again, Kubrick excels in picking some great classical music to supplement the film. Music that's now sort of inseparable from 2001, even though it was not written with any sort of association to it, obviously. I think Keir Dullea is pretty perfect in this movie. He obviously is not asked to do a lot expression-wise, but I think sort of his serious nature is perfect for the movie. You can feel his underlying stress in certain moments, but it also sells him as sort of this aimless drifter, like that things are out of his control, he's just getting pulled along for this crazy ride, that he's just a pawn in sort of this wider thing that's going on. I don't want to say too much about sort of the greater narratives of this movie and trying to dissect sort of the ambiguity of it, because I don't want to ruin that for anybody. That's something that is very, very fun to discuss after seeing it with friends, though. Trying to break down what exactly the movie's trying to say about technology, about the way things evolve and progress, about, like, kind of human achievement. I know I'm speaking in very vague and ambiguous terms, but I don't want to say too much for fear of ruining it for somebody who's never seen this, because this is a movie that, even though it is obviously mentioned in the breadth of his other famous movies, your average movie fan is going to see The Shining first, probably see A Clockwork Orange first, might even see Dr. Strangelove first. I don't know. I feel like maybe you get to 2001 a little bit later down that path of watching Kubrick movies. I might be speaking totally out of turn and sound really dumb in saying that, but I think it's possible, you know? I don't want to ruin this movie for anybody because it was completely untainted for me the first time, and it was just such a mind-blowing experience. Now, what's interesting is 2001 set such a crazy precedent that so many movies would try to follow for decades after, that if you do go in to watch it fresh, you probably can figure out a lot of, you know, where certain turns are going to go, because there's just so much that 2001 has kind of influenced and set an example for down the line. But still, nothing quite matches up to the original. So much creativity in this movie. Sequence after sequence, it just enraptures you. It's my number one Kubrick movie, pretty much with ease. I think it's not like a giant step to the next one, to The Shining or to Barry Lyndon, but it has a pretty sizable lead, I would say. I love, love, love this movie. A movie that many people wouldn't consider rewatchable because it moves at such a slow and deliberate pace. I thoroughly enjoy every second of it. What more is there to say? I feel like I'm beating a dead horse because there's just been so much talk about 2001 and The Shining and some of these Kubrick classics in, you know, film criticism spheres for years now. That's like, what am I even adding to the conversation? It's hard to not feel that way when you're talking about some of these classics, but especially Kubrick's movies, which are so heavily studied. And yet he's a man who's still sort of an enigma. There's a lot of unknown about him. He was sort of a recluse in a lot of ways. It's such a cool contradiction that his movies are so intensely studied, but the man himself, we don't tend to know a ton about. And I suppose that's where this list leaves off, with 2001 A Space Odyssey at the top. I couldn't see it any other way. Kubrick, man, that guy was pretty good at making movies. All right, we are going to do some spoiler talk just for that one moment in Eyes Wide Shut that I referenced, just because I want to just mention it again and how amazing it is. But I did happen to check out sort of four supplemental Kubrick things after finishing Barry Lyndon and all of his movies. And I figured I'd discuss those here because why not? A little bonus content. So I watched three things and then I actually read something that I want to talk about. I know, movie fan doing some reading. That's quite absurd. But anyway, the things that I watched. So first I'll mention that there is a great 30-minute making of The Shining that was shot by Vivian Kubrick, Kubrick's daughter. Sort of a behind-the-scenes look at some certain segments of the production, mostly during the production, not anything pre or post. And it is quite an enjoyable watch for several reasons. First, very small detail. We start off in Jack Nicholson's room, and it just is so funny to me because he leaves the room, he walks down some stairs, and then walks like 10 feet, and he's in the main hall, like the main lobby of the hotel that we see so much of throughout the movie. And it's just funny to me thinking about that, like when we're watching the movie and we're in that main lobby at the start of the movie or other scenes throughout the movie, that like Jack Nicholson's room is like kind of just right off camera over there. It's just funny. I don't know. It's kind of silly, but something I thought I'd mention. Other great things you see in this behind the scenes. You see Kubrick at work, the method and the madness a little bit. You see sort of his anger start to come out. You see Jack Nicholson channeling his psychopath side to film some of these scenes. Kubrick figuring out where to put the camera in some of these moments is just so fascinating because you're like, he's just on the fly creating some of the more iconic shots in this movie. It's just really interesting to see him work in that way. You see Shelley Duvall quite frazzled, quite stressed, and it's hard to not feel sympathy for her when watching this. It's just an all-around great look at The Shining if you're a Shining fan, if you're a movie-making fan, and it's only like 30 minutes, so I highly recommend checking it out. It's on YouTube. I also watched this little 45-minute special called Stanley Kubrick's Boxes. It's about this journalist who is invited to look through Stanley Kubrick's archives. He kept tons and tons of personal boxes for all of these scripts and prep material and photographs and props and everything. And this guy's getting to kind of explore them, some of the methodical archiving and storage of Kubrick. There's some pretty cool highlights in here, just looking at some of the props, all the photographs Kubrick would take to just like pick a hat or pick a location. Learning about sort of the precision that Kubrick would work with from, you know, starting up a production to even just the marketing afterwards. You learn a little bit here, and it's interesting. I feel like it kind of diverts a little bit into some other tangents that waste some of its 40-minute runtime. It's like you don't actually get that much of the content of the boxes in it, but not a bad watch overall. Also available on YouTube, I think, is where I watched it. I can't quite remember where I watched this. I feel like it was either on YouTube or it might have been on, like, Vimeo. Anyway, if you just Google it, if that intrigues you at all, it was not too hard to find for free. So I definitely recommend The Shining behind the scenes more. And possibly more than any of them, I recommend the final documentary I watched, Film Worker. If you don't know, Leon Vitali was an actor who appeared in Barry Lyndon as Lord Bullington, and he worked with Kubrick and he said, this guy is an absolute genius, and he threw away his acting career, which was quite promising at the time, and basically became Kubrick's right-hand man on call 24/7, his, you know, kind of his assistant, his sort of his wall for Kubrick to bounce ideas off of. It's a portrait of a man who recognized genius, gave himself into it, but kind of lost himself along the way. There's sort of this hope to it of like this, you know, this loyalty and the amazing creative processes they went on. But there's also kind of this sadness to it of like working yourself to the bone and kind of attaching yourself to this man. And I feel like a psychologist would have a field day watching this movie and trying to understand Leon Vitali and his intentions and motivations and why he's doing what he's doing. It's a great portrait of him. It's a great portrait of Kubrick. It has a ton of great anecdotes about the making of some of Kubrick's classics and the things that he would ask Leon to do. And then you kind of see those come to fruition. Some of the research for the movies. It is a fascinating documentary. I highly recommend it to any Kubrick fan. And the very last thing I mentioned, I read something. I was at a used bookstore and I found this memoir called Eyes Wide Open, a memoir of Stanley Kubrick. And I was like, Kubrick memoir, count me in. And it was written by Frederick Raphael. He's the screenwriter for Eyes Wide Shut. And I went in with high expectations. I was like, I was so excited to read this book. And I was it sold itself as Raphael had so many amazing conversations with Kubrick, and we're going to get a in-depth look at those. This book was very disappointing. There's one main reason, and that's Frederick Raphael as a man, an author. I mentioned that Kubrick is definitely a control freak. He was kind of abusive in the way he would work. But somehow Raphael kind of comes off way worse in his own book. Like, he's so much more annoying. Pretty much every page is saturated with these statements of like, I'm so much smarter than Kubrick. His creative contributions pale in comparison to my genius. I'm so cool. I'm so funny. It's like, this guy clearly has a massive ego, and it was really bothering me throughout reading the book. It's like, I'm no staunch defender of Kubrick and his working ways, but I'm like, this guy was so full of himself when you would read his discussions with Kubrick. He would just like throw these offhand remarks onto every page. It's like, yeah, my French was, you know, a little bit better than Kubrick's or so-and-so. And at one point, he's so excited about Kubrick giving him positive feedback on a script that in the book, he's like, I can only express the feelings I felt then in French. And he just does the rest of the page in French. I was like, bro, come on. There are some interesting anecdotes about developing the ideas of Eyes Wide Shut. Seeing some of the precursor ideas and how they would build into what you now know as the final movie is interesting. And I liked reading it overall, but it was tainted a lot by Raphael. Just kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth, even though you get some good insights out of it. I would have preferred if literally any other Kubrick collaborator had written a memoir like this. You know, I just mentioned Leon Vitale, but any of those other minds that worked with Kubrick a lot would be great to hear from, except maybe this guy. I did appreciate his quote that was, to find Barry Lyndon boring is to admit to having no eye. I was like, all right, nailed it. I like that line. But yeah, not a book I'd go out and recommend. If you're like a Kubrick completionist, it is a very light read. It was like 180 pages. You could blitz through it. But I won't go out thoroughly recommending it to anybody. Raphael really, really thoroughly bothered me throughout. Okay, I think I mentioned earlier that I might talk about one moment in Eyes Wide Shut that I wanted to fanboy about. I don't even think I'm going to do that anymore. I don't know. I feel like any sort of spoiler talk for this episode would just be me discussing favorite scenes and like sort of geeking out about them rather than providing anything interesting. And it is a ranking episode. It's not really like a mini review or anything where I would actually want to be analyzing these things. So I think I'm going to pass on any spoilers. Kubrick's movies are such in the public consciousness that half of my favorite scenes are like iconic scenes that everybody knows. So I don't really want to add anything to this conversation at this moment in time. I'd be happy to talk about Kubrick all day, but it's like just putting this into a podcast of me echoing what everybody already knows just feels sort of fruitless. So no spoiler section to this episode. Just go watch his movies, you know? I don't know. It's like there's no other director where he has a movie for everybody, I think. There are some. I think, you know, Spielberg probably has a movie for everybody. I probably spoke a little bit out of turn in saying he's the only one. There's a couple, you know? I think Spielberg has a movie for everybody. I think you could maybe argue Scorsese has a movie for everybody. But I think Kubrick's certainly up there at the top of that list of like, yeah, he's done every genre. So pick your favorite genre, check out Kubrick's version of it, and you're not going to be disappointed more than likely. It is so cool seeing a guy bounce around and just nailing every single possible category of film. Like, that's pretty impressive. I think I'll do a sci-fi now. Okay, now I think I'll do horror. All right, now I'm going to do a Vietnam movie. You know, it's like, okay, dude, what can't you do? And this is where I'm like, what am I even adding to this conversation? Everybody knows Kubrick is a genius. Everybody knows Kubrick's a great director. So I don't really know why I'm just like, go watch Kubrick movies. Like, yeah, real insightful, Dylan. But that brings us about to the end of this episode. Kubrick ranked. I will really quickly recap my list in order for you. I think I've been very hit or miss on when I do that versus when I don't. Like, I don't think I did that on 2022 ranked, or did I? I don't know. I'm blanking on if I did it, but I'm going to do it here because I, as a podcast listener myself, when I listen to an episode like this, I always do like a recap of kind of where we were. It helps put it all into comparison directly rather than kind of scattered throughout the episode. So, of Kubrick's 13 feature-length movies, again, Fear and Desire kind of straddling that line. At number 13, we have Fear and Desire. At number 12, Killer's Kiss. At number 11, Lolita. At number 10, The Killing. At number 9, Spartacus. At number 8, A Clockwork Orange. At number 7, Eyes Wide Shut. At number 6, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Don't think I said that full title earlier. Might as well do it now. At number 5, Paths of Glory. 4, Full Metal Jacket. Number 3, Barry Lyndon. At number 2, The Shining. And of course, number 1, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I don't know if I gave my ratings for all of these too. I think I might have fallen off the wagon on that, partially due to having to break this recording into multiple sessions, as I mentioned earlier. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I probably was sharing the ratings up through Dr. Strangelove, which I gave it 8 out of 10. If there's a little miss somewhere in the list here that I now have not said the rating for, oh well. But Paths of Glory I have at a 9 out of 10. Same with Full Metal Jacket, Barry Lyndon, and The Shining. And then with a 10 out of 10, of course, 2001 A Space Odyssey, one of my favorite movies. Kubrick, what more is there to say? That about brings us to the end of this episode, guys. I thank you guys so much for listening. I know I say this every episode, but big gaps between episodes, and I'm sorry, and I wish I could record more. Just know if you have gotten this far, I really appreciate listeners like you who still tune into this podcast even when we go on massive dry spells. And I know, and still tune in to hear me say this every single episode. Like, it must be really old by now, me just saying sorry for not making episodes. So thanks for sticking through that part as well. Check us out on Instagram at CineStudyPodcast. Email CineStudyPodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to share your Kubrick rankings. I love seeing how Kubrick rankings stack up because they can be so wildly different, but I feel like pretty much all of them, you're like, yeah, I understand that. Like, there's no like crazy hot take opinions because all of his movies have such a baseline quality to them. Letterboxd is at FilmDylan, possibly the best place to go if you want to see what I'm watching, see some lists I'm making, and just interact with me on there. I love using Letterboxd. And highly recommend it to any movie fan. You probably have it by now if you're listening to this. So, all right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of Cine Study, episode 51, Kubrick Ranked. Thank you guys so much for listening to me rant about Kubrick movies and how good they are, and I'll catch you next time.